Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. We're shooting today at Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan. I want to remind you, by the way, to join us at facebook.com, facebook.com/UNC Knowledge, facebook.com/UNC Knowledge. Dr. Larry P. Arn received his undergraduate degree from Arkansas State University and his master's and doctoral degrees, both in government, from the Claremont Graduate School. He has also studied at the London School of Economics and at Worcester College, Oxford. He is a founder and past president of the Claremont Institute. Since 2000, Dr. Arn has served as the 12th president of this institution, Hillsdale College, and has still found time to write and teach on our topics today, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And our time is limited because you've got to go off and teach the fifth book of Aristotle's Ethics. Is that correct?
Correct.
Ordinarily, I welcome people to Uncommon Knowledge, but this is your campus, so you welcome me, Larry.
You are warmly welcome.
Thank you, Larry. Segment one, what the founders gave us. I'm quoting you. You can read the Declaration and the Constitution in a few minutes. They're simple, they're beautiful, they can be understood and retained. Place the documents in their historical context. Why did they matter at the time?
Well, they're very, there'd never been anything like them in history. There still is nothing like them. But remember the King of England, who was a nice man, by the way, and a humble man for a king, was referred to by the title Majesty. And it took the founders, a lot of them, for a long time thought, the only way you can have stability is if some family is appointed to rule. And so the king was a very humble man, but when his son wanted to marry somebody, a noble, but of lower station than the king's family, he said, princes may not marry subjects, ever, no matter what your heart says. So the point is, that's the world, right? That's what's known. And that's the first incredible thing about the Declaration of Independence. There are three. The second incredible thing about the Declaration of Independence is in the last sentence. The Declaration of Independence was written by people for whom the military was looking. General Gage had an order, and the order said, find these people, even if it means complete war, detain them. In other words, they were guilty of treason. Mm-hmm. And now they're going to put their name on a document and send it to the king. And they write in the last sentence, in the mood that somebody who was about to do that would write. In support of this declaration, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. That's how people talk on a battlefield. They die for each other. We mutually pledge to each other. That's the second extraordinary thing. And then the third becomes more amazing because of the first two. The opening of the Declaration of Independence has nothing to do with them. In fact, it demotes them. It's not our unique situation. It's not us, a special people, here to do a grand deed. It begins universally and abstractly. When in the course of human events means any old time, it becomes necessary for one people, means any old people, to dissolve the political bands that have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth a separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. It's an act of obedience to a law that persists beyond the English law and beyond any law that they might make. So for them to be the particular people whose lives are at risk, and for them to be turning over an entire way of organizing society that had dominated for 2,000 years, and then for them to begin that way, it's very grand, but also you can't miss it, it's partly humble. These are the ways that people must comport themselves. We are going to do that. And if you will do that, British, we will get on. And if not, we will not. And we will be in the right because of that. So that's what's remarkable about it and why it's very beautiful, the Declaration. And it connects to the Constitution. You have to first know that modern scholarship claims, and you know, Gordon Wood and Joseph Ellis and famous people, excellent scholars, claim that there were two foundings, one for the Declaration of Independence and one for the Constitution. And they mean different things, is the claim. And by the way, that's a very powerful thing because if it's true that they changed their mind right in the middle of the revolution, their example to us might be, we can change our mind whenever we want to. Mm-hmm. But the Constitution doesn't read that way. The Constitution has three grand things in it, and they're very lovely, and they are all commanded in the Declaration of Independence. The first is that government be limited in the Declaration. And it's limited in obvious ways, right? Mm-hmm. It's a doctrine of enumerated powers in the mm-hmm. Constitution. There's a list of things that the Congress can do in the Constitution, and the other things that it's not listed, it may not do. And you'd think that's some change from the Declaration, but in the Declaration, the middle part of the Declaration of Independence is the charges against the king.
Right.
And if you want to understand American constitutionalism, its basis, read those. Because the things that the king has done justify the revolution, and they amount to violations of constitutionalism. So he has sent swarms of officials among us to eat out our substance and harass our people. He has brought troops from a foreign jurisdiction. He has, so in other words, it's a breach of limited government. Mm-hmm. But once you have limited government, you have a vast, big society that's independent, and you can locate sovereignty in it. Now, James Madison takes pride in the 63rd Federalist that this is the first form of government in which the sovereign does not operate any part of the government. It is a, and this is the second principle, mm-hmm. it is a representative form of government. It is limited, and because it's limited, it's possible for it to be representative. And what that means is, in the government, nothing will operate except that it gets its authority from outside. But since everybody's human who's going to get governed, then you don't want the people outside to be of unlimited power either. And so they can only act through the government. They can't act directly. They can talk and talk and talk and argue and argue and argue, just like we are right now, mm-hmm. just like you did beautifully last night in your speech about Reagan. But we have to wait for elections to do anything. That makes us more deliberative. The charges against the king in the Declaration of Independence are full of a list of where the king, the executive branch, has messed with the legislatures and the judges and disrupted representative institutions.
Larry, segment two, losing our way. You've referred to the Declaration and the Constitution as beautiful documents, significant documents, and you've just told us why, to the extent that one can in a limited time. I quote you again, Larry Arnn. Woodrow Wilson and the founders of modern liberalism called these doctrines of limited government that appear in the Declaration and the Constitution, obsolete. They argued that we now live in the age of progress and that government must be an engine of that progress. Now, Wilson was dealing with conditions that the founders could scarcely have imagined: industrialization, dense urban populations, particularly on the East Coast, enormous waves of immigration. So what's so wrong with Wilson's effort? Maybe he got a little wrong here, a little wrong there, but he's attempting to adapt the American founding to quite new conditions of modernity. What did he get wrong?
First of all, he liked to look back on the founding as a simple age. You know, remember what it was like. You know, there'd never been such a thing before. They had to declare an entirely new set of principles by which to govern and make war on the biggest force on earth. And they named it, the Congress was called the Continental Congress. Mm-hmm. They hadn't seen the continent, didn't, until Lewis and Clark came back to report to now President Thomas Jefferson in 1805, mm-hmm. I think, right?
Yes.
So vast acts of imagination. And then they had to figure out a way for the first free government in history to grow across the continent. In other words, they faced enormous complications. And the idea that the complications of the 19th century are larger is bunkum.
So the first clue that Wilson is off the mark is that he appears to be condescending to people who were very great men.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, we have a simple age. You know, we have more now. But The second thing is a very easy thing to see. It's a core thing. What is the reason behind constitutional forms against which Wilson rebels? Madison says it is written in the fact that we require to be governed because we are not angels, mm-hmm. but government must be limited because angels do not govern men. And so that means that just as we outside the government require to be governed, those inside the government also require to be governed, and that has to be strictly arranged because they need and they will have a lot of power. Now, the judge right now is very easy to make between Madison's claim that it's an abiding and eternal fact that the equality of man is found in the fact that men are not angels. Mm-hmm. And Woodrow Wilson's fact that evolution, which is what he thought was going on, had got us to a place where we didn't have to worry about that stuff anymore. And judge, look at the government today.
Take a look.
Is it impartial? Is it efficient? You showed that speech by Reagan from 64, the time for choosing speech last night. And that, I'll say to your viewers, described brilliantly, beautifully, how you attempted to emulate that speech in composing another of his greatest speeches about the Berlin Wall. What does he say in that speech? What he says in the speech is what's obvious for all to see. The modern bureaucracy is not politically impartial. It is not politically disinterested. It is obviously and massively self-interested. And what James Madison said, and remember, when James Madison is setting up a limited government, he understands that he himself is likely to be a very large figure in it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't set up a government where he himself
can do
whatever he pleases, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. He becomes, he and Thomas Jefferson are the founders of the political party that destroyed the Federalist Party and ruled the country for 60 years. He succeeded his friend Thomas Jefferson as president of the United States. He was the maker of the institution that kept the president from being all powerful. So he's not saying anything against the characters of people who are alive today, except the simple thing that they are human and not angels.
Larry, you've written that some now argue that nature is not really the commanding conception in the Declaration, but history is the commanding conception. And I found that very interesting, the way you contrast those two. Would you do that for us now?
Nature means two things in this context. It means the thing itself. Itself. It means the cup is a cup. It has a cupness about it. It makes it a cup. And there's lots of different cups, but you can see the cupness in all of them. So whatever the nature of a thing is, whatever it is specifically, the nature of the human being is to reason. It is the animal that can reason. Now, the second thing nature means is the process of beginning and growth by which living things come to be. The word nature actually comes from the Latin word for birth. So the nature of Peter is to be born a little boy and get older and, you know,
gray hair, causes, stop there.
Causes parents troubles until he's about 26. You know, they're 18 to 21 years old around here, we know. And then, you know, you become the man you are. And then I watched you taping a show that you're going to be shown with Paul Ray, and you guys were both speculating about your death, right? You know about that. That's your nature. So When you look at people, it doesn't actually matter from the point of view of nature whether human beings used to be monkeys. What we know is, if you look at the things in nature that are before us now, this human thing is a very distinctive thing. And it can't be treated like a pig. That's a famous historical example. Stephen Douglas says to Abe Lincoln, he says, "You think that I can take my buckboard and my hog into Nebraska and the federal government has to protect my property in it? Why not then my slave?" And Lincoln replies, "Just fine if there's no difference between the hog and the slave, but you know the difference. Because if you just look," here's an example of mine, not Lincoln's. I can give you Lincoln's if you want me to. "If you go read the Alabama Slave Code," mm-hmm. which was a very bad one, there were restrictions on how many slaves could get together and how long they could stay together and how long they could be indoors together. And those were generally waived in the case of meeting with a qualified minister. Now, they put all kinds of fences around their hogs, and they didn't make exemptions for the hogs to go meet the minister. But they did the slaves because they know what they are. That's the nature of the man, and the rights of the man are written in the nature of the man, and you cannot mistake it. Now, if evolution, by the way, evolution, in my opinion, if it's true, and I don't even care if it's true, because it's quite beside the point, if it could repeal that, in other words, if what we think is, and remember, Woodrow Wilson thinks that things are evolving very fast, you know, because he's writing what you're quoting in about 1880 or 1890, and the founding is about 100 years before. And he thinks that all of the fundamental conditions have been repealed by time in 100 years. But have they? You can see that they have not. So if you think that evolution is supplying some standard that permits people to do whatever they want to do, that's only a good idea if they're not still people. But what if they are? What if the nature of the man persists? What if it's true that you and I, people of goodwill who've known each other a while, and would be ashamed if we knew about each other that we did something wrong? What if it's true that neither of us is quite the man that George Washington was? Nature. Something made him really great. Doesn't happen very often.
Larry, you've spoken about the attempt to restore some rounded and rigorous sense of constitutional government. And you have put forward, in a speculative tone, in a tentative tone, not trying to lay down law, but put forward suggestions to prompt thought and so forth. Four pillars. Let's go through them. Pillar one, and I'm quoting you, protecting the equal and inalienable rights of individuals is government's primary responsibility. I'm with you. Here's a problem against which to test it. In current circumstances, something like 47% of Americans now pay no federal income tax. And we hear a great deal about the tipping point, the moment at which more people become dependent on the federal government than pay into it, the moment at which they become, to use Paul Ryan, Congressman Paul Ryan uses these terms, more takers than makers. Now, what is it within the Constitution, as within a revived constitutional government, that prevents this majority from simply voting itself the property of the minority?
Well, the first thing is it's larger self-interest, rightly understood. Is that practice working out really well in Greece right now? You know, the point is, Margaret Thatcher, you know, pretty soon you run out of other people's money. And, you know, I myself am not particularly gloomy about that tipping point thing because...
You're not?
Not really, because, I mean, I think there's a time coming when we're not going to be able to repair this. But I think it's because things are so controversial right now and because the political contests are so narrowly drawn and because the polls show how many people think the government's out of hand and doesn't represent them anymore, I just think that that's proof that we haven't passed the tipping point yet.
The people have not yet been corrupted.
I don't think so. And I think, you know, people are, you know, I've had the privilege of studying Winston Churchill for a long time. And his great touchstone, his great prudential step that he would always take, and I think that should be the model for us today, is that let's try to make the questions clear to people and have faith in them. Because, you know, maybe we think they're clear to us, but we're not empowered to rule them against their consent. Our job is to explain. Any citizen who thinks he understands, his job is to explain and see how they react. And I'm optimistic partly because the explanations have not been very good since Reagan. What if they were better? You know, and by the way, in other words, it's kind of encouraging that we're not very good. Maybe we could get better.
Okay, pillar two, quote, I'm quoting you, Larry. Economic liberty is inversely proportional to government intrusion in the lives of citizens. We must liberate the American people to work, to save, and to invest. Close quote. I'm with you. But here's a constitutional question. Milton Friedman noticed this. James Buchanan won a Nobel Prize writing about it. the deep structural problem that in the American federal government, the benefits of federal spending accrue to small groups who therefore have incentives to organize and agitate for more and more and more spending, whereas the costs of federal spending are diffused across the whole population, so no one has a counterbalancing incentive to organize and agitate against spending. So you get this ratchet that always leads in the direction of greater spending. Along comes Ronald Reagan and tamps things down for a while. And then Ronald Reagan departs the scene and is right back at it. So there is something, the argument goes, based in human nature, Lord knows we're not angels, but that the Constitution seems not to have grappled with.
2 points.
Yes.
One is, don't blame the Constitution. It's the longest surviving and greatest in human history. And the effort to overturn it is now more than 100 years old, and the major breaches have happened pretty recently. So it's not a failure of it. It's a failure, it's a success of a rebellion against it, which has been very systematic for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But second, public choice theory is a very powerful thing and a true and sufficient explanation of things as far as it goes. But doesn't it work a little different in a time like that now? Because now, it's not a case of these, you know, Milton Friedman loved to argue. I have been proud to say that guy was a friend of mine for 30 years. And I just adore him. And I had the good privilege not to be his student, so he was never tough with me. His students were all afraid of him, and he made them better.
I caught the edge once or twice.
Yeah, I bet you did.
Mostly friendship.
I bet you did. You know,
once asked him a question, and then he answered it, and I said, well, I guess I've taken enough of your time. And he said, yes, you have.
Oh, there you go, Peter. Yeah, see, he's a quick little devil. And he used to say, subsidies to farmers are going to grow, and subsidies to old people are going to decline, because there's so many old people that for us to give them $100, it's going to cost us $175, and we're going to fight against it. Whereas with farmers, there's so few of them that for us to give them $100,000, it only cost us $10, and so we won't fight it. That's public choice theory in
a
nutshell.
Right, right.
But isn't the problem now that everybody knows we're broke? Right? And everybody, you know, unless there's an abiding or overarching sense of fairness that touches a majority of the American people, and I believe there is, then if there is that, though, constitutionalism looks more attractive than it used to look. And so if you took, say, and this is too grand to be a plan, but it's a notion, if you took the Paul Ryan plan, which is in strict terms unconstitutional, and you implemented it, it would be a step back toward constitutionalism.
Why? You lost me right there when you said it's strictly speaking it's unconstitutional.
Well, you know, in the strict sense of Article 1, Section 8, education is not mentioned, retirement benefits are not mentioned, health care is not mentioned, and there's no congressional power over those things.
Okay.
And so I believe myself that what you should do is talk about separation of powers, representation, and limited government, and try to get those back. And Article 1, Section 8 is a much longer term project. But
you're willing to play along with Paul Ryan because he's at least moving us back toward.
Also, he's a great man.
Right.
And, you know, I was disappointed along with many when he didn't run for president. And I was one of those who urged him to do it. But take his plan. And then the thing is, it's a good plan. And it's in the longer term interest of everyone, that plan. The retirement benefits that we get will be protected. The entitlement state, its promises will be vindicated. And it would be terrible to invest all that money and all that expense in this system and then squander it. Better to save it. And if you do save it in the right way, it prepares for a next step in which more of that stuff would be local or private.
Okay. On to the next segment here. We're pillars 3 and 4. Pillar 3, quoting you once again, to accomplish its primary duty of protecting individual liberty, the government must uphold national security. Close quote. seems perfectly straightforward. The government has a duty to protect me from you, to protect me from the government itself, and certainly to protect me from terrorist attacks from outside. Okay, now two quotations. Larry Arn, quote, promotion of democracy and defense of innocence abroad should be undertaken only in keeping with the national interest. Pretty limited. George W. Bush in his second inaugural address, quote, the survival of liberty in our land increasingly depends on the success of liberty in other lands. The best hope for peace in our world is the expansion of freedom in all the world, close quote. Larry Arn thinks George W. Bush was just overreaching there, or where do you want to place yourself? Where do you want to place a correct understanding on the spectrum of Ron Paul on one hand and George W. Bush on the other?
Well, first of all, Ron Paul makes an important error. He says we have 600 bases overseas. We have about 20 with any sizable number of troops and about mm-hmm. 8 with a large number. If you count ambassadorial detachments,
right.
You know, so I don't agree with that.
Right.
That's false. But I side with Winston Churchill and Thomas Jefferson. I side with what I just wrote. Jefferson said, we are the friends of liberty everywhere, custodians only of our own. And that's just a practical understanding, right? It's, you know, I pray that Iraq is going to be a free country, and I think there's a chance of it, and I give George Bush credit for that. I was skeptical. And God help us, I hope it happens.
Right.
But it's complicated. And you know, so a senior person in the White House said to me one time, don't you think they want it? And I said, sure they do. Have you read the Federalist Papers? And do you divine from that that that's enough? So the point is, it's hard to do that. And
hold
our
on,
own strength
Jefferson,
is...
Where does the attack on the Tripoli pirates fit in?
Well, they were attacking our people and our shipping.
Ah, okay. It was very limited. He sent the then very small United States Navy across to Africa to whip a small number of pirates. It was a limited operation. He wasn't attempting to establish a rule of democracy across what was then, Cyrenaica?
And look at, first of all, prudential things
yes.
are not subject to narrow rules in advance, right? That statement by him, you know, he was a particularly gifted individual, friends of liberty everywhere, custodians only of our own.
Pretty good formulation.
That's a brilliant guide, right? Now, do I think we did a good thing in Japan? Sure I do. Why? Because they did a terrible thing to us, and darned if we didn't go level the place, and there was an opportunity in that. Seize it. It would have been a false economy not to.
Mm-hmm.
But does that mean that in every country where there's a threat to us, we won't be safe until they're all democratic? The answer is probably. That's true. But is making them democratic practicable and the most practical way to serve our security? Probably not.
All right. Pillar 4, quote, the restoration of a high standard of public morality is essential to the revival of constitutionalism. Now, you say public morality. So here's a test case. Forgive me for mentioning it in these august halls. But Bill Clinton did something improper in private and lied about it under oath and created no end of uproar. And his supporters always said, it's all a private matter. It has no bearing on his conduct as president. You all ought simply to forget about it and leave it alone. How do you deconstruct that incident in our national history? And what I'm getting, who cares about Bill Clinton? God, thank goodness we can now say that about the man. Who cares? What I'm trying to get at is your distinction between public morality and morality per se.
Well, public morality, by the way, is laws about morality. It's, you know, what we think is, you know, murder is a moral harm. But I mentioned that term nature earlier, the process of begetting and growth by which people come to be. How do kids grow up? Here's what you learn if you work in a college. They're 18, 19, 20, or 21 years old, except for our two 80-year-olds. And you know, the 80-year-olds, their parents are not calling. But the 18 and 19 and 21-year-olds, 20 and 21-year-olds, if I call their home, I say, this is Larry Arn, and everything's okay, even if it isn't. Because they're worried if I call.
Oh, I see.
You see?
Right.
And the point is, if they were some other kind of creature, they wouldn't know who their children are. You see? Human beings were made for the family. Mm. We should uphold that. It's hard to raise a kid, you know, and takes a long time. So things like that. But then another thing is, the government is so large now, and it does so much, that it's very difficult for a free people to keep track of it. And you know, there's just thousands of things going on right this minute. You know, we're probably worse governed now significantly than we were when this interview started. And that's and that's saying something, you know? So it, how can you keep up with it? And that means that when it's so big, and so big in relation to the rest of the society, I think these numbers are accurate. I think the gross domestic product of the United States is $15 trillion, and I think state, local, and federal spending is $6.7 trillion. Half, I think, would be $7.5 trillion.
Right.
So we're $800 billion away, and health care is coming. If it gets past that $7.5 it just means in money terms, the government is larger than the rest of the society. How can the rest of the society watch it? Of course, there's endless possibilities of corruption in such a thing.
So as a constitutional point, that's the kind of morality you're talking about. We haven't discussed this, but out of sheer curiosity, morality in the culture at large.
That too.
The sort of garbage language in pop songs these days, or the proliferation of porn on the internet. That degrades the people?
Very much, yeah. And see, you know, like right at this college, we don't have politically correct crimes, you know, but you're supposed to be civil around here, right? Mm-hmm. Don't be foul. Mm-hmm. Straighten up, huh? Mm-hmm. And we don't have many problems because they've subscribed to that before they come. And that's a condition of good order in operation. You mentioned, I'm going to teach this afternoon.
Right.
If you know, unless they have a bad day, which they do, they're going to have worked really hard for today. And I'm going to get there and they're going to know stuff. And I'm working, you know, I was sitting back there while you were talking to Paul. I'm trying to get ready for class. And I've been reading that book for 40 years. And what's that about? That means a bunch of people come together and make a common effort, and it is successful because they're all working on it. That's a microcosm of constitutional rule. It's a miracle what can be achieved in a country if everyone is governing himself. And it is this simple thing, this is the most important thing for people to understand. Free people are not governed by rules. I can show you how that doesn't work in this college because we've tried. They're governed by goals. And then the rules are very broad. Tell the truth, don't cheat, take care of other people. You know, those are rules, right? But if the rule is, you know, the rules on colleges from the federal government, I'm told that they number now more than 500 pages. And I was told once by our attorney, because I asked for them, we don't live under these rules because we don't get that money. I said, send me that, I'd like to read it. He said, you're not going to be able to read it. And I said, you know, what do you think I am, a lawyer? I'm a pretty smart guy, maybe I can. And no, he said, I can't read it. Mm. And see who gets powerful under a system like that?
Right.
Whoever has the power to interpret it, they can do whatever they want.
Right.
So. That's the point that I would like, I hope that the American people will come to understand that in America, we're supposed to have a very powerful government and a great deal of government, but it is to be of a different character than the kind we have today. And that distinction is fundamental.
Larry, our final segment, how can we get there from here? I'm quoting you once again. There is only one way to return to living under the principles of the Declaration of Independence and the institutions of the Constitution. we must come to love these things again. How?
Well, you have to know about them. Partly I confess it. I'm like the hammer who looks at everything as if it were a nail. And everything is a teaching opportunity, right? But the great presidents are teachers. You know, what Reagan's speech that you showed last night, and contrast it to some recent presidents without naming any of them, Reagan was this big-time explainer. Mm-hmm. It's a generous thing to do to somebody else to lay out what you think, to labor to make it clear to them, not to be, to invite them into your thought process, which of course you can't do unless you make it more clear than it is if you're just talking to yourself.
Right.
That's a generous and fine impulse. That's why Abraham Lincoln's speeches are beautiful. I like that word because that's a good translation of a fundamental Greek word called kalon. To kalon, Aristotle says, it has therefore been kalon said that every human action aims for the good. The highest form of the good is the beautiful thing. You can't read some speech of Abraham Lincoln if you read it carefully. I had this experience one time. I've been studying Lincoln since graduate school, and a friend of mine, Lou Lehrman, wrote a book about Lincoln's Peoria Address. And I started reading the book. It's a very good book.
Peoria Address is 1838.
No,
early?
It's 1850.
Sorry.
Six, I think.
Okay.
And it's Lincoln's history of slavery.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And you're thinking of the Lyceum Address.
I am, correct.
And I hadn't read that thing for a long time, and I read the first chapter of Lou's book, and it's very good. And I said, I'm going to sit down and read that book, read that speech again before I go on, because I'd read it many, many times, but not for a long time. And about 30 minutes later, my wife came in the room, and she said, are you okay, dear? And I said, yes, I'm very well. And she said, are you crying? And I said, well, I was a little bit. And she said, why? And I said, you should read this speech. It's lovely. Because it's a simple and fine explanation of the history of slavery in our country. That great man, Lincoln, went into the Springfield Library and spent months putting it together. And today, I can remember roughly how slavery moved in our country because he lays it out. But then he combines that at the end with this lovely explanation of why the principles of our country are capable of reaching and protecting every human being and ennobling them because they get to participate in rule. Now that's beautiful. And to know that is to love it. And so what we really just need is for people to know that.
Larry, from the sublime too, I hope it's not ridiculous, but it sure ain't sublime in itself, the current Republican field. Where is the Lincoln? Where is the Reagan? Marco Rubio's out. Paul Ryan is out. Mitch Daniels is out. I was chatting with Michael Barone, our mutual friend, a couple of weeks ago. Michael is, I believe, the finest political journalist in the country, largely because he's such a good historian.
Yeah.
And Michael, I said, how do you rate the current Republican field? And he said, none of the people I would consider in my top 10 for accomplishment and talent is running for president. Why? What does that say about the state of the Republic?
In the classic books, statesmanship, which is a very, very high form of human art, the political art, is so rare that it's sometimes used as a synonym for chance. And we're in a very frustrating period right now because there are some great ones, it looks to me like, and they're young, a little too young. And I think if God gets done with us, you know, he might put things out of whack in just that way. Now, but on the other hand, they're alive, the ones we admire. And you know, Peter, you're alive. You know, that matters. There are people here in this room, they're alive. It matters. We're not done. And we don't know what's going to happen. We just know what we're supposed to do. Now, about these guys who are running right now, I think the only thing wrong with them, because you know, By the way, I don't in general think that politicians I meet are bad people. I think they're even above the common run. They're ambitious.
You have a good, good heart, Larry.
A lot of them are very... Now, what I do think, though, because remember, I'm a hammer, and I think of things like a nail, but a lot of them, they haven't had the privilege or taken the privilege of learning deeply. That's not on offer much anymore. Used to be, you know, and it used to be that everybody learned a bunch of really cool stuff about American history, because it is really great. And, you know, the founders were slaveholders, right? That's what we dwell on now. Well, we should dwell on it. Because, by the way, how did they come to proclaim those principles being slaveholders? Look at it hard. You'll find out it's a proof of their sincerity. And so if you started out a political career understanding that there's a center to America, and that one of my jobs is to become an expert on that because I'm going to use it, then even an ordinary statesman would be made extraordinary. And we're not doing that today.
Larry, last question. You're the president of this magnificent institution. It's small. It's in the middle of the lower tier of Michigan. And everything is an hour and a half or 2 hours away.
Isn't that great?
Okay. So how do you think of Hillsdale College? Do you think of Hillsdale College as part of a movement of restoration that is gaining strength? Or do you think of Hillsdale College as a kind of citadel or monastery where the faith will be kept even despite the gathering dark age?
It's the first, right? We're not putting up defenses around here. We're on the attack. No, what I think is the college is, first of all, it's very beautiful in its beginning, right? It had so much to do with the coming of Abraham Lincoln to the presidency, right? And it's, I mean, some of our students were pallbearers for him. And that's because they had earned that place in blood. You know, they were very serious people back here who started this place. I came here mostly because of them and because of the things they wrote. But then what do you find out when you work here in a place like this? First of all, this place is, the students come here from every corner of the land. And we got more applications than we can deal with. And why is that happening? Because of the attraction of beautiful things. You know, when I say that I believe if people understand the founding of their country, they will love it. First of all, I love it. But second of all, I watch people come to love it all the time. And making, because, you know, another thing about it is we give C's here. And you know, you go somewhere else, you can get A's. And why
I take it back about that big heart of yours.
Yeah, you know, I'm telling you, it's not me. I'm not the worst around here, I can tell you by a long shot. There's a couple of guys that are just ogres. And the kids tend to love them. So the point is, that is a rich and great experience to participate in, but it radiates. And it radiates for a lot of reasons. Every college, by the way, radiates around itself because the attraction of what happens in them is very powerful. And if they're ugly, by the way, they ugly radiate in an ugly way, and some of them are that today. Now, we radiate particularly much because we're strange. 50 years ago, 60 years ago, the college made a decision not to take any money from the government. And it reiterated that decision under three presidents now. And that's a crazy thing to do. It's just, I mean, nobody would look at that and think that was the least bit financially sensible. But it drives you somewhere. You have to talk to a lot of people. And you have to justify what you do inside and outside constantly. So that means that the college is a force for understanding of national reach. That's a valuable thing, we think.
Dr. Larry Arn, 12th president of Hillsdale College, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Peter Robinson from Hillsdale College. On behalf of Uncommon Knowledge, thanks for joining us.